Hello and thanks for joining the Walt Weekly Podcast Friday Live. I am your host, Walter Latham, along with your co-host, Michelle Sweeney McCombs. Also, we're here with our panel of thought leaders who are tough, smart, and dedicated to ensuring that they ask the tough questions and get the answers that will inform our listeners, or at minimum, make you aware. All right, before we get on with the show, let me announce that we have rolled out the Walt Weekly Podcast Sports Edition, which is now on YouTube. Full video, folks. I mean, really, you will enjoy it. Please check out. Right. Yeah. Please check it out. This show is being hosted by Gregory Coleman and Chris Sweeney. And this is the first of more shows that will be dropped in the sports arena.
Awesome.
Okay. And why we're doing that is to just expand our footprint and try to reach our demographic, which are the young folks. We're trying to reach the young folks so they can learn something. At least we can give something back. And that's the mission of the show, to give something back, right? So anyway, let's get on with today's show. All right. So what is an activist? What does an activist do? There's a saying that one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. Our guest today is the real deal, folks. So without further talk, let's walk the walk and turn it over to Michelle Sweeney McCombs. Hey, sis.
Hey, bro. Thank you, Walter. And good evening, everyone. And welcome to the Walt Weekly Friday Live. Thank you to our live audience guests. Thank you for joining us. Please follow the Walt Weekly and share this podcast by clicking on the share button at the bottom. The Walt Weekly Friday Live is sponsored by Beauty Blends by Ami, Soap and Love, and Michelle Sweeney Hair. Our intro and outro music is provided by Uncle Nephew. Our panel guest today, weekly panel, is Gregory Coleman out of North Carolina, COO of Illumination Media and Technology and engineer at the Walt Weekly. Our next panel member is Ernest J. Robinson out of Washington, D.C. He's a sergeant, U.S. Marine Corps, combat veteran, senior consultant at B. Ernest Leadership and professional consultant. Our next panel is Christopher Sweeney out of New Jersey, a retired sanitation worker and CEO of Johnny Roof's Catering. Our next panel member is Honorable Gene Anthony Edwards, male district leader, out of the 79th District in the Bronx, New York. I will turn it over to Gregory Coleman to introduce our esteemed guest that we have today. Greg?
Thanks, Michelle. We're privileged this week to have Terrence T.C. Muhammad. Terrence has been a community activist and organizer for over two decades. His experience spans voter mobilization campaigns, issue advocacy, and coalition building in African-American communities, faith communities, and on college campuses. He works at the intersection of economic justice, criminal justice reform, climate and environmental justice, youth empowerment, and community health. His primary role as community outreach manager for the Hip Hop Caucus is to coordinate grassroots mobilizations with advocacy agendas at local, state, and federal level. TC is from North Carolina and proudly wears the banner of Aggie, having studied psychology at North Carolina A&T State University. He remains very involved in his local community while raising his son. He's also family. So let's give a big welcome to Terrence T.C. Muhammad.
Yay, Terrence!
Great job, Greg. Knock that out.
Yeah, you knocked that out. Bye-bye.
All right. Yes, Terrence, thank you. We're honored, man. We're really honored looking at the things that you've done and doing. We're really privileged to have you. But let's get on with, what constitutes or what makes up an activist? You hear people saying online or just, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But looking at your body of work, I'm just astounded that you of what you've accomplished. And I'm also astounded by the people you met. And I'm a little envious in a way that you can meet people like President Obama and Reverend Louis Farrakhan, Honorable Louis Farrakhan, and people like that. So with that said, my first question to you is, what motivated you to become an activist? You know, what triggered that? What lit that candle?
You know, first, let me just say I am honored and very humbled to be on this show. I don't take it for granted. You know, I would say this year marks 30 years of me becoming conscious. As people say, I became conscious, and it was 30 years ago. So to be at a place where I can share these experiences is very humbling. And at the same time, when I say that, I still see myself as a baby in a movement, because I'm still being taught, I'm still learning from those younger than me, but then my elders that are still amongst me, still walking and still, I'm still on this journey. So I still got a long ways to go. But I do want to say that, yeah, the process of me getting involved in where I am didn't just happen. It didn't just like, I didn't grow up, like I heard my sister and my friend Tamika Mallory, she said she grew up in a household, in an activist household. So she didn't just start, you know, at the Women's March. She didn't just start with her organization Now Until Freedom and working with Brianna. She's been active. She's been involved and engaged. So I grew up, you know, if anybody knew, say I grew up in the church. So I was known for at the time, Chapman Boys. So that's what I was known for until I got to North Carolina State University, student government or conscious. I wanted to go to parties. And literally, that's what I did. I went to all the parties and I was known. And there was a brother that asked me, his name, Ra'ante Amena, used to be Eric Short. He asked me when I was at the parties, I'm come to this meeting. And the meeting was called, it was a meeting for the History Club. And the History Club was known on campus for the Afrocentric Black Radical Black Power organization. And I went there and I started learning about the Ankh, learning about Kemet, learning about Egypt, heard stuff I had never heard before in my life. And I went to a black high school, never heard it in church. I've never heard this knowledge about our history and never heard it while I was at college until I went to this meeting. And once I went to this meeting, we didn't just sit around philosophizing, talk about our greatness. We was actually in the midst of a fight for mandatory black studies on a black college. And at that time, black colleges were not teaching or having a black studies department. A lot of the white colleges was having it. Just like with hip hop, black colleges didn't start studying hip hop and the culture of hip hop until after white colleges start to study it. But I was in the midst of fighting for mandatory black studies. We was organizing students on campus. We was having forums to educate about our culture, about our history. We organized students to do rallies and take over the administration building, take over different buildings on campus and be in classrooms and speaking out. But it also took me to go off campus, to go into the community. And my mentor, Irvin Lee Brisbane, rest in peace, he's the one that entered me into being a community activist outside of doing stuff as an activist or socially conscious person just on a campus. Because sometimes we just get caught on a campus and not translate that work and that information into the communities that need it around these institutions.
Okay. My next question is, you know, define activism. I know the panel is going to kick in very soon, so I'm going to throw these little softballs to you underhanded. You know, what is an activist? You know, define activism.
I mean, I think.
What
that,
do you think?
I think that definition is going to be changing, and it has been changing over the years. But when we knew it, it was somebody that was actually engaged in the issues of the community, someone that was actively bringing information. They was sharing information, they was inspiring people, they was mobilizing people, and they was organizing people. And those are two different things. We can pull people to come to a rally, but can we organize them around an issue, organize them to stay focused to win an issue? So activists, usually sometimes people see them as this person that's screaming in the wilderness. As you say, somebody's activist be somebody else's terrorist. And sometimes as a student activist, we was always seen going against the administration, but we were seen as a friend of the students fighting for the concerns of the students. So it's more so about what are you actively engaging and what issues are you bringing to the forefront? And usually activism is looked upon as a person who's fighting against oppression and in defense of the oppressor. But that definition, you know, it changes so much because you have certain people that consider themselves activists on social media and they just talking. They may not be doing anything. They just may be sharing information. They are considered activists. They may be just showing video clips of different things and they consider themselves an activist. I think for me and my upbringing, activism was me hitting the streets, literally going into the community, talking to folks, finding out what were their issues, what were their concerns, and leading the charge and helping in the charge for fighting for whatever they needed to be at the forefront of. So it was always fighting along with the people and for the people versus the new model of some people swooping down and saying, hey, I'm here to free you and defend you, but have not had the engagement of talking to folks in the community. So I would just say, okay, it's about pushing and fight for an issue.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for that. Because there's many interpretations of activism, of activists, rather. So, and I really wanted to hear it from someone that, you know, not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. You know, we got too few of them right now. So, in the environment that we're in, which is very toxic and divisive, and, you know, we're getting people killed left and right, our folks being shot down, you know, shot in the back and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just a horrible situation. The issues that are going on now in this environment, I mean, does that make you more active now? Are you, you know, your guys calling up, you know, your colleagues and things of that nature? Let's get out. I mean, you know, you probably was already doing that, but I'm just saying, and, you know, what's your guys' take on the current environment?
You know, I do a lot of stuff around environmental justice and social justice, and, you know, we talk about climate change and the climate has changed, the environment is changing, and that's the same thing with people. But I saw something on social media one time, and it was like George Floyd was not the wake-up call. George Floyd is the same alarm that's been going off for since we've been here. We just kept hitting the snooze button. Right. So we saw Trayvon Martin, we hit the snooze button. We saw Michael Brown, we put the snooze button. And I think what happened last year, because of social media, we saw Ahmaud Arbery, we saw Breonna Taylor, then we saw George Floyd. My issue right now, as far as, yeah, people have been mobilizing because of COVID. We haven't necessarily been as in the streets, but people still came out in the streets when George Floyd was murdered. And a lot of people have taken to social media. But I think for me, here's the issue that I have. In 2015, I remember being at a national meeting with all these civil rights organizations, big organizations, and they was talking about what we need to do, and we need to push this issue of body cams. And that was the push for Michael Brown body cams. And I was saying, you know, what are we going to do? Because Michael Brown is not going to be the last one killed. What are we going to do to change? And a lot of people are running to legislation. So we now got body cams, but you can't see the body cams. So one of the things we got to do, we have to go back into our communities and make our communities a decent and safe place to live. And then we can make sure that the police don't need to be in our communities. And there's the whole conversation of abolishing the police and defunding the police. And what does that mean? And what does that look like? So more and more conversations are coming. Some are saying defund the police and use those resources to go into the community programs that are actively educating our young people, actually giving jobs to our young people and creating opportunities for our young people versus you coming in with the intent on killing our young people, because you're not coming to save and be the defenders of justice. You are actually breaking justice in our community. So more and more people are getting aware. A lot more people are getting involved. I just think that we have to do more of not just stopping them, but more so of making our communities a actual community. Because we say community, but the reality is in a lot of places, we don't know one another and we don't come together in the places where we live. At one point, we used to can say that the community was the community and everybody knew one another and we shared a common purpose and a common familiarity with one another in a community.
Mm. Very true. Yes. I like the angles, the convergence there, you know, from our community to, you know, the police. I like that. That's the, you know, that's something that we really have to work on. I think it's more in our control, because without any type of unity, and we can't even think about it going out to really fight the external battle of the police. And as far as defunding, I don't believe that's something that we should worry about right now. I don't think that's viable. All right. So anyway, now I got the panel out there. Yo, guys, before we move forward, I'll let you know whether I got any questions coming from the panel for Terrence.
Yeah, I got a couple of questions. And it largely has to do with what you just talked about, you know, our communities. I sometimes I'm torn, you know. We talk about, you know, how much devastation comes from outside of our community. But sometimes we have to look at, you know, some of the devastation that's done within our communities. And I know there's a cause and effect, you know, on both ends. But I grew up in an era where, you know, in the 70s, where, you know, we really didn't trust the police. But I think a major difference was we trusted each other in the community a little more. There was that activist spirit, that enlightened spirit that was, you know, amongst everyone in the community, young and old. What do you think we need to do to reengage that, to ignite that spirit again within our community?
I mean, one of the things that Walt just said is unity. You know, unity is our greatest weapon that we have yet to use. If we unify in buying land and owning our own and creating our own and not being the number one consumer and holding up a industry and a corporation and a system that is killing us, we can do better. But we need to first come together. I think one of the things we also got to realize is that when we talk about this whole issue of activism, part of activism is also understanding how do we get in this condition. And also, let me get back. Let me go say this. Part of activism is some people do it for a job. Some people do it for a fad. Some people do it for a moment. But my activism came out of a love for our people. And that love started when I started to love myself. You have to love your people more than they hate themselves. And when you see our people, you got to understand that they and we are a damaged and destroyed people. Yes, we have work to do on ourselves, but we have to understand there was a root cause and there was an intentional destruction on us as a people during slavery and destruction in the 60s and the 70s. And that same destruction is going on now, whether it be a food desert, whether it be the school to prison pipeline, whether it be infiltrating our music, infiltrating our organizations, or this still mindset that we want to integrate into a system that does not love us. We didn't never want to integrate with our open enemies. We wanted the same opportunities and the equity of resources to do what we was doing already for ourselves. So we have to go back to that sense of unity and community and build back our communities. But also we have to defend that and maintain that, which we get as we're coming up on the 100-year anniversary and commemoration, or not necessarily commemorate the remembrance of Tulsa, Oklahoma. What we were doing for ourselves, and anytime we did for ourselves, someone would come and bomb that and destroy that. So part of that work, yes, is keeping the enemy off us. We have to start with unity. We also have to have more love for our people than they hate themselves. We got to understand that we are at war. We are under attack. And unity is our best solution to come together, that we can do something for ourselves. But we have to understand that we are a destroyed people, destroyed from slavery, destroyed from the civil rights movement, destroyed now from the school to prison pipeline, the prison industrial complex, all of the things that they're putting on us. We got to understand that we have to come together in unity to give ourselves a better situation and put ourselves in a better situation, because we're not being taught properly in the educational institution. It's really a killing field for our children. Mm-hmm. We have to start going back and building our communities, teaching ourselves, giving out also our own opportunities for jobs and entrepreneurship. So it's a lot that we have to do. It's a both and. While we're building our own, we have to keep the enemy off of us. So activism can be on both fronts. While others are dealing with legislation and policies and dealing with all that, others should be acquiring land, buying land, and building on those lands and producing and giving opportunities for our people. We should stop trying to run to be somewhere where we're not wanted and to build our own society and our own communities and gain wealth and ownership. We the richest group of poor people, meaning we got $1.1 trillion that we spend every year, but we're not the number one producers of the things that we use.
Absolutely. We're just consumers. Yeah. I know I had mentioned a couple of times that, you know, one of the main problems we have is that we embrace integration. Like, okay, right. You know, I want to be there. I, you know, this integration. But if you look back, and I was maybe 10 years old when a lot of this was going on during the protests back in the 60s, that really undermined the family structure, our family unit. We became members instead of, oh, yeah, I know Walter, I know his mother, I know his father, and I'm going to make sure that he has a great education. All right. That to me, tracks back to then when we have, as to what we have today. And what we have today are a lot of young kids on the street without any type of guidance, without any type of role models. At least you could find them in school when I was going, because I went to an all black school. Okay. I'm from North Carolina too. So Eastern North Carolina. All right. So I track back to that. So, you know, I do have that framework where everything was within the neighborhood. We didn't need any outsiders. Everybody had a grocery store. They had this. The only time we had to go with big box items like television or, you know, stereo. And so, but otherwise we didn't have to go outside the neighborhood and we really didn't care. You know what I mean?
But the reality is we left slavery. We left slavery and built 60 towns. The reality is we built America. You didn't see a white man with a hammer. You saw us building this. So we are capable and able to do for ourselves, but we are under this mental shackles that we cannot do something, build for ourselves when we are building and continues to build everybody else's world. So like you said, the whole okie doke and integration was we wasn't fighting to be with our oppressor. We was fighting for the equity and the resources to do what we was already doing. We was owning our own shops, our own factories, our own everything, movie theater, restaurants. We had our own, but as soon as the mentality was this ice is colder, this is better, we're going to give up everything that we have to take ownership to just go and support somebody else's. And that's why a lot of organizations that are black are still funded by white organizations so they can make sure that they are in control of the directions that we go. There are few people that are taking the stance of ownership. And that's why I do like some of the folks in the hip hop community, because as not only they're doing the music, they're getting restaurants, they're getting houses, they're building and making sure they take ownership. And that's the thing. So we lost that ability to own our own and be in our own community once we gave that up through the process of integration.
Yes, yes. That's what I was alluding to. That is major. Another thing, too, is, you know, I've been fortunate enough through work to travel all over the world and just live, you know, where I work, basically, for months. All right. And one thing I found out, even in Africa, I spent 10 years going, you know, doing the gold business in Africa. I also did some gold mining. You know, so I used to be up in the bush. I mean, really. Way up in the bush, no roads, no electricity, no light, took baths in the river, things of that nature. So I was a lot of times in the jungle, but I was also in places like, you know, Singapore and Tokyo and places like that. One thing I did find out, and I realized that, and it hit me hard, was the fact that the African American is the least respected group on earth. Least respected group on earth. Now, I know that was a lot of it was perpetuated by media. And, you know, like when people think, for example, when people think of Africa, the first thing they think of is, you know, somebody running around with a bone in their nose or, you know, a spear or, right. you know, a thing. No, mm-hmm. no, it's not like, I mean, you got, just like you got different neighborhoods, you got different areas in America. You got different areas in those countries over there.
Right.
Africa is a continent. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you got the, you used to have a middle class in some countries, you know, like Ghana, the Ivory Coast, you have, you know, middle class, you have poor people, you have rich people. But they never show the middle class and the upper middle class people that live in those countries. I mean, you can point this back to PBS and all these nature shows. I mean, this goes way back. Okay?
Yep.
So we are the least, the African American, not to get off track here, but the African American is the least respected group of people on the earth.
And not only that, and you said the reality is that's the image that's being pushed around the world. And so when in 1995, October 16th, when we had the Million Man March, the world saw the image of the black men in a whole different reality, because white media showed up at the last minute to show the world, because they couldn't believe that a million black men would show up, and nearly 2 million men showed up and come in peace and unity. So they knew something was going to be tore up, trash and everything. But nearly 2 million men showed up in love, peace and harmony, and left the mall with not a trace of trash. No record of any violence during that day. Matter of fact, the violence went down that day at the Million Man March, which was broadcast all over the world. And I say that because that was the beginning of a new image being shown. But here's the problem, is that, as you said, we don't see that Africa is a continent, the largest continent, three times as large as America. We also don't understand that there's riches in Africa, and Africa will be okay if the colonizers will stay out of Africa. If you can just stay out of Africa, Africa will be okay. Africa is not a starving country. Africa can feed its own self and the rest of the world if they was left alone to do for themselves. I have two friends that just moved to Rwanda. Great opportunity in Rwanda. They opened up a restaurant. They're opening up a bed and breakfast where people can come to Rwanda. The bottom line I was saying is that there's been negative images shaped around the world on black people all over the world. But of course, black people have been seen in a certain way because we have been the only people that have gone through what we've gone through. So we are actually in the worst condition, but we are the ones that are going to change the world condition. So exactly. It's that this is the people that God's going to use, that material, the bottom rail that will be raised to the top. And the reality, as I was saying, the Million Man March showed the black men in a different light. And people all around the world saw the Million Man March and saw black men standing up and taking responsibility. And now black people are starting to go to Africa, and not only go to Africa, live in Africa, settle in Africa, get dual citizenship in Africa. And I was saying, I got friends in Rwanda. They have opened up and moved to Africa. So one of the things that America and European countries never wanted, they never wanted the black man with the knowledge that we have in America to unite with the resources and the wealth of Africa. Whenever we went international, that was the biggest fear of our enemy, that we would connect with our family throughout the world. So they understand our power, because our enemy is the minority and we are the majority. So we should never call ourselves a minority, because the black man and woman is all over this planet. And I mean all over China, India, and definitely in Brazil.
I agree with that. Yes, sir, Rebar. I got to put a clap on that, because I like the way you said that. All right, before we move on, I'm going to go to the panel.
Hey, Walker, I would just like to say, this is Gene. No, I would
Chris?
I would just like to say that, you know, I think the same, you know, negative imagery that gets shown in Africa, you know, when it comes to black men, especially, you know, inner city, you know, black men, you know, it's the same negative images that we see, you know, over here in America. You know, I remember growing up watching TV commercials. They always show, you know, images of Africa, these children with the Biafra bellies with the flies on their eyes, and they're, you know, playing in the mud, eating the dirt. And I said to myself, why would I want to go over there? Now, they watch the news, and they see the gangbangers and the gangster image of the black man in America. And so when they come here, especially the Nigerians, they call us Akata, which is the African way of saying the N-word. You know, they, basically it means savage over in Africa. So because of the imagery that they show in Africa, they don't show the Q stomping the yard. You know, they don't show the Kappas with the canes on the quad, black men being educated. They don't show that stuff. So that's why when Africans come here, we think, you know, they think we're savages. The same way they show images of the Biafra babies, they don't show those beautiful metropolis in Kenya, in Nairobi. They don't show those beautiful, I mean, there's some parts of Africa, like they were in the 21st century, back in the 20th century. When they were building, the only thing they did wrong was they invited China in because China saw, you know, what Africa had to offer. That's the only mistake they made. But as far as the imagery, that's why I say, Walter, I disagree with you about, you know, the black man in America being hated all around the world, because the truth of the matter is everybody wants to be us because we have the creativity of the African, but we speak the king's English. And we understand the psychology of the European. And I'll digress.
No problem, Gene. I appreciate that.
No. And you said some powerful stuff. And one of the things that America is always, you know, America is a is a land of hypocrisy. How dare you talk about African children when it's your brother in Europe that's causing the starvation of our African brothers and sisters? And how dare you talk about save Africa when the black men and women in the streets of America are dying and can't get a job? You got Vietnam vets that fought for America and still catching injustice here in America. So America is the most hypocritical country where we, you know, you look at other countries talking about third world, but they have free education. They have free health care. You don't even want to take help from Cuba, but Cuba, like I said, give all of their students free education, free health care, but we can't even get free health care. We up here making people up here making billions and billions of dollars in corporations, and folks are still waiting on some stimulus checks. So America is just a hypocritical country, and you're right. I don't always blame the artists in music, some of the stuff that's been put out there, because we understood that in the 90s, hip-hop, there was a culture, there was a teaching that was in hip-hop that started to educate us, started to enlighten us, started to lift us up. And once they heard that, the record industry went to work to change what they were allowed to be put out and put on the airways. No other people were allowed, no other company, those that ruled the record company, don't allow people to talk about their people like that, but they don't mind us degrading ourselves because they want to push that. Because the more violent we are, the more savage we are, the more that they can get us into their prison industrial complex, which are privatized to make more money on us, because slavery was never abolished in no 13th Amendment. We are still modern day slaves. So these imageries are the things that they want to see. So these podcasts are starting to help people get the information and the imagery that, oh, there's something different in Africa. Oh, there's some beautiful lands in Africa. There's some beautiful buildings in Africa. They got roads. They got cars. They got modern stuff. Yes, in Africa. But we were never taught that. We were never shown that. So they want to make an image go out throughout the world. But now with the help of modern technology, our technology, they are seeing a different image of their brother. And we're seeing a different image of our brother and our sister.
Yep, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I've never seen that part. You know, I was in Africa, like I said, for 10 years during the 80s, I think 81 to 90. All right, on my quest to, you know, to get rich, because, you know, everybody, when we're young, you want to get rich and retire at 35, right? So, you know, I was there. And I never forget, I met this diamond dealer. He also dealt in gold, which was, like I said, that was my thing. Anyway, diamond dealer during the rainy season, he was telling me, oh, man, my truck, you know, the bridge just, you know, broke and my truck went in and I lost it. This is Land Rover he's talking about. He said, but anyway, you know, I'll just get me another one tomorrow. I'll just order another one. It's no big deal to me. And the guy came up with a bag of diamonds that would blow your mind. You know what I mean? And I said, no. Go. But just to show you how rich these people are, where all the natural resources of the world is focused, is concentrated right on the continent of Africa. That's where the riches are. And I've always encouraged, and I do encourage, and I'll take this opportunity to encourage people to take a look at Africa, look at the possibilities. Just make sure that you don't go there and underestimate the people on the continent based on what you're seeing on television, because you'll definitely get hurt. You'll definitely get hurt because they're very smart and they're very astute business people. All right, those are our brothers, but I have to refer to them in that context. All right,
but you also said something very important, that there are diamonds, that there are so many riches that the Europeans go, and now China is all up in Africa, buying up Africa like they buying up America. But there's diamonds in there, but you got to go through Europe and get the value of them. But they got diamonds. There's some places in Africa that the diamonds are just laying on the ground.
Oh,
Africa,
yeah.
Very, very rich. And they know that, and that's why they have settled in Africa and are ruling Africa and ruling governments in Africa and causing problems and going in and causing coups and everything so they can take the land. And that's what they are doing in America. So all of our parents and all of our grandparents that had land, now they are taking that land from our young folks or making us not even want to keep land. Because they understand real estate and they understand land is what has a value, but they want us to have the little trinkets while they go and take our land.
That's the way it is. And the sooner we realize that, the better it is. I want to move over to the panel. Chris, you were getting ready to say something earlier.
Yeah, how you doing, TC?
I'm good.
Well, we sit here and we're all aware that, you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy in this country. We don't control the narrative. We don't control the media. We don't control a lot of things in this country. And we have so many of our younger brothers and sisters who don't want to vote, who don't want to get involved because they think a lot of those things don't matter. I want to hear from you. What methods, what's the best method right now, in your estimation, that we could take to educate our brothers and sisters out there, and to, you know, it's a fight here with everything we do. We already know that, right? Because we don't control the narrative and we don't control how things are going to be, but still we have to push forward, right? So, right. What in your estimation is the best goal, the best way to achieve what we're looking for, aside from us saying that, you know, we need to unify? All of those things we're aware of, right? But if we say we need to unify and we don't control the narrative, how do we change that? How do we still move forward?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, you said, and not, you know, the rest of you, a lot of times we say, well, we know unity. And we say we know it, but we have not done it, right? So we have to do it. And then the other thing is getting in control of the narrative. And what is the narrative? We have to produce our own medium of information exchange to get that out to the community. And sometimes we look at the bigger picture, and we know in politics, all national politics starts locally. Local politics is national politics. So what are we doing in our own sphere? So the first thing is starting with ourselves, getting the knowledge and acquiring knowledge and studying that knowledge and then passing it on to one of your friends and your family and then your community. And then you start with a particular area and grow that. And just like every organization starts small and then grows. But I think that conversation about the voting issue, one of the things I say to people, I say, if you ain't never been in my hood, stay out of my hood when it comes to election time. Don't come around talking about you want to vote for me. You want me to vote for you. And I don't even know you. And I've never seen you around in my neighborhood. We are tired of people playing the games and getting votes and not doing that for our people. So one of the things that needs to be shifted, we don't need to wait to the primaries or election time to get our young people and people in general involved in the political process. People need to understand civic engagement 101. What does that look like? Where is the power dynamics? You know, who has the power to affect you? So young black man, you got this child support and you worried about the mayor, and you ain't dealing with no getting some district attorneys in there that's going to help you deal with your case. You know, we have to understand that the lay of the land. We got to have those people that understand politics to teach politics in a way that our young people will understand. One of the things I've done in the Hip Hop Caucus, we use hip hop artists and their celebrity to get young people involved in the process of getting out to vote. But we also have done something like what 2 Chainz, who was an ex-felon, T.I. was an ex-felon, Charlamagne Tha God was an ex-felon. And we started talking to ex-felon about how to fight to restore your right to vote. Or in North Carolina, if you serve your time and pay your fine, you can vote, and letting them know that so they can get involved in the political process. And in Virginia, at one point, people were saying, I'm an ex-felon. And we stayed in Virginia after the election. So we were nonpartisan, but we stayed after the election as well. So we made sure that Virginia turned that over to let the returning citizen get the right to vote. Desmond Lee in Florida was doing the same thing. But we have to deal with the issues. It's not about get registered and go vote because people died. No. What are your concerns, and what is the way to address your concern and get your concerns changed? So we have to be able to listen to our young people. Sometimes the reality is we don't know how to speak the language, or with our young people, we don't want to listen to what is going on. And then the reality.
Let me stop you there for a second. I agree with everything you just said, but the one thing that we got to do is, yes, like you said, not vote for the guy that's just coming to the neighborhood when it's time to run for, you know, for office. We got to produce people in those communities that they want to, that they see every day, and they want to vote for them. Because if we don't produce those people, the only choice they have is to vote for the guy that's coming around every so often.
And that means that we have to start grooming brothers and sisters early, getting them involved, so when that time comes to run for a seat, for a position that we need, then they already have the training, they already have the experience, they already don't have the know-how to be in that position and be in place in that position. The reality is our community are not organized. They say, what are our issues? And we select somebody from our community to represent us. That's what other folks do. They send folks into office to represent them. And usually it's the business community, so they can represent their interests for their business. We have to organize and say, who are we going to select and train to put into a position to run for it? Ross Barak was the mayor of the people, but he didn't just go to the office by himself. He took people with him, and he kept working in those communities. He was in the streets, and we have to groom people like that to be in those positions to get the resources that we need. And not everybody's going to be a politician. And we don't need everybody to be a politician.
Absolutely. Thank you.
No, I was going to say that was a great question, Chris. And that was a great response, TC, right on point. And, you know, since you guys, have entered my universe, I could tell you about running for office and politics. Can't tell you about America, but I could tell you about local politics here in New York. There's only 2 ways to get elected: either be known for something or raise a lot of money where one can confuse the vote. And TC, I think that's what you were trying to allude to when you were speaking of, you know, candidates coming into your hood that never been there before. They raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they put up posters everywhere, and they flood everyone's mailbox with these mailings. And because of voter misinformation, miseducation, they think that the person that they see the most must be the favorite. And that's how raising a lot of money can confuse the vote, as opposed to someone who's grassroots, who started out working within the communities, being a community leader, a community activist like myself. You know, I was known for what I did for the South Bronx, so I didn't have to raise a lot of money. People already knew that they wanted to vote for me because they knew that I had their best interests in mind, because I am of the community and I stay within the community. And with that, I'll digress.
But that's the reality. So how do you fight against a money campaign? And that's why I said, when you talk about activism, you have to make yourself known. So you got to be everywhere, but you got to, when you are really in tune with the people and you love the people and the people know you love them and they see you and they can recognize you, they, it's a name that you know. It's a name and face that you recognize. So when they may see all these other posters, but they don't know that person. No, I know Raheem. I saw him the other day. He came by my mama's house to help my mama. And it's that kind of politics that we got to have. And that takes support. And the reality is that when we see a good candidate or we see a good person that we know is doing what they do, I don't care if you got $5, give that to the campaign. Lend your time and effort to help put someone in a position that we know has moral character and a love for us. And that you know that the resources are going to come back. But you're right. And New York is just like any other city. If they got more money, they're going to put out more resources. But the reality is the best way to fight that is if you're known, like you say, if you're known in a city and people know you and you have the ability to mobilize and organize people, that's where your strength is. And of course, with politics, you just got to make sure if you got dirt, put your dirt out there early to get that clear and get through that. I mean, that's the real reality. It's like, look, yeah, I was in jail. Okay, what? Now I'm not. I know a brother that came out of jail and he got a fitness center. He's all on TV. He's doing whole lots of stuff now, but he got that out the way. You can bring on my past, but what am I doing now? I'm an integral part in the community, making a difference and making a change. So you can't use that part of my life to stop me from moving forward to do the work for the community. But that politics is very tricky. But I always say the politics of working for your people and knowing your people, because regardless if you're in a position or not, if you got the people backing you, I don't care who has the position, you ain't gonna have the power if you don't have the people.
All right. I see that you're also involved in environmental issues.
Yes.
So what are you doing along those lines? Could you explain?
So one of the things let me back up. So when I got involved into environmental stuff, I had no clue. I was working at Hip Hop Caucus 2012. And in 2013, I ended up in Nebraska at a state hearing talking about the Keystone Pipeline. And I thought it was climate control. I didn't even know it was climate change. But as I started getting into it, I realized that there's this big conglomerate called dealing with climate change, but then there's also Black folks that's been dealing with environmental justice for years. Warrenton County of North Carolina with Dr. Ben Chavis, they was fighting, you know, around this issue of environmental racism. The reality of it is I don't talk about the polar bears and the ice caps and all that, even though that's a reality. I deal with the power plants that are in our community, the landfills that are in our community that's causing asthma, that's causing health issues in our community, that's causing birth concerns in our community. So when they want to put pipelines in certain communities and contaminate certain people's water, they go into the quote-unquote path of least resistance. So when they were putting a pipeline in North Dakota, they went through Standing Rock instead of the white community of Bismarck, because they wanted to make sure they go where they thought was the least resistance. So as far as the environmental justice, we're fighting for clean air, clean water, like we see in Flint. And Flint is not the worst of the places that don't have clean water. There was issue with lead with Freddie Gray. We saw Freddie Gray get killed in Baltimore, but there was lead issues in Baltimore. There's lead issues in Newark. So we are trying to make sure that we get afforded the same clean water, the same clean air. And one of the examples that we use is that, like Eric Garner, we saw him on camera in New York get literally choked out by police. But we don't see the silent deaths, like his daughter, Erica Garner, having an asthma attack, and she died because of the air quality there. And she had an asthma attack, heart attack, coma, and then died. And there's a lot more deaths because of environmental racism that affects our communities the worst. And then when we see the environmental changes that come, we're hit and we're left with dead as we saw our people in Katrina. So we're trying to bring that issue to those areas that are actually affecting us. And even with the EPA when Trump was in office, trying to roll back the regulations in Louisiana, like we have Cancer Alley because all of the toxic waste or the coal ash that dumped in North Carolina, and they were going to pull back the regulations, say you ain't got to regulate nothing, but people were dying because of all this toxin, and that's why the regulations were needed. So the environmental justice movement, there's a lot of people in this, and there's a lot of people fighting because we have so many fights on so many fronts, and all of them stem from racism in every area that we deal with.
Okay. All right. Any questions on the environmental, the climate activities that TC is involved with? Now, on a lighter note, TC, I see that you went to AT&T. Not AT&T. Okay. All right. Let me tell a story. You know, I'm a storyteller. You know, I like to.
I just woke up.
My kids say, okay, here go the old man again, talk about the past. You know, did it really happen? Yeah. But anyway, I went to Louisiana City State University when I was 19. I was a trumpet player. Okay. So anyway, and of course, I majored in music. I was a music major. Football. So wherever the football team went, the band went. And I was in the band. Okay. But anyway, as part of my mandatory, as part of my major, I had to take piano, right? Piano one, piano two. All right. So Dr. Davis, she was the chair of the music department. She was preparing to go home for, you know, the end of the semester for the Christmas holidays and stuff. So I helped her move the heavy daggone boxes, helped pack her car, put everything in the trunk. And by yet, she was the one I took piano one under. So, of course, you know, I'm going to eat some cheese, you know, if I can, right? And so I said, okay, Dr. Davis, by the way, you know, you all set? Everything ready? She said, yeah, thank you, Walter. And I said, oh, what did I get in piano one? Well, I'll see you next semester, Walter, because you failed. So that's one thing that I noticed about, you know, HBCUs. They make sure that you learn. You're not just there to pay money. And that's an example that I wanted to give out that, you know, HBCUs, you get an education. You're prepared to compete on the world stage. You're just not just a number. You're not just an athlete. You're going to do the work. All right. Now, see, if that has changed since I've been there, then y'all guys have to tell me, the younger guys. But that was my experience
Let me say this. I still am and wear the banner of a proud North Carolina Agriculture and Technical State University, North Carolina, A&T, Aggie Pride all day, but I love all HBCUs. And I say I love all HBCUs because, like I said, yeah, I am a proud person who attended North Carolina A&T State University, and I love all HBCUs. Yeah, as I said, I can always say this over and over again that I attended North Carolina A&T State University, but I love all HBCUs, and we're not an afterthought. We are the first thought, and the reality is that we got to remember it was a black woman that went to Spelman that got us Georgia in that runoff, in that Senate runoff. And it was an Aggie that's now over the EPA. It is a Bison who is now the vice president. You know, so I wanted to say, if we think that, you know, HBCU don't prepare you for the world, but somebody who's running the Environmental Protection Agency of the United States came from an HBCU. The one who sit in the seat as the first black woman as the vice president of the United States came from an HBCU. So, you know, sometimes we say that, and I remember an astronaut, Ronald McNair, went to a HBCU, and we can go down do the roll call of who came from HBCUs, and they are very instrumental in raising people. See, one of the things about HBCUs, they make sure not only do you learn, but they make sure that your character, they want to make sure that you represent your family. I've been to HBCUs where I didn't have to go hungry. They made sure I ate at HBCU. There was people, there were so many mothers at HBCU. People help people get through life situation at HBCU because you're seen as somebody significant. You make bonds and family bonds and lifelong bonds at HBCUs, and we are very much so needed. Now, being from an HBCU, I'm going to talk junk to another HBCU. I'm going to talk junk all day
long. I knew it was coming.
I talk junk all day long. But when an outside enemy attacks one of us, we all come together, unite, and defend our brother or sister institution, because we know an attack on one HBCU is literally an attack on all HBCUs.
Nah, I just been sitting here listening.
Are you on mute?
No, I'm not on mute. I'm talking.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah, you have a delay.
I got a latency.
I've just been sitting here listening. You know what TC has done, you know, has been powerful. And I appreciate, hats off to your level of consistency. Oftentimes as a veteran, people say, you know, thank me for my service. And then, in this sense, as an activist, from one to another, TC, I want to say thank you for your service. And what in your new role, I know, Walter had brought it up about what you do with the environment, but what's on the horizon right now for what you do in your current role, and then what's on the horizon for TC, the man, the activist?
You know, that's the question that I'm gonna have to take off this show and try to figure that out. Why do I say that? Is because in the environmental movement, there is a time limit. There's like 9 years left that we have to get to 100% renewable before this planet is just totally just already messed up. We got maybe 9 years left. That's what the science says about the environment, right? That's one thing. The other thing is the climate is getting so bad that if they don't stop killing us, I don't know what we're going to see in the future. And so when we say what's coming on the horizon, I'm looking at a reality than the reality that we live in, a place where we can have some clean water and some great air, and where we and our children are living in peace. Because I'll be turning 50 next month, and I wouldn't want 50 years later, if I'm around, or 30 years later, when my son gets older and he's almost 50 and talking about dad, they still killing him. Dad, we still like that. What did you all do to prepare a world for us better than what you all had? And I don't want to hand over a world to my son that's worse than what he's getting. So I think for me on the horizon as an activist is one, I'm not, and I never am looking for retirement, because you never retire from your love of your people or helping. You may switch different works, but I think all of the fronts and just finding my place in it, you know, and because everybody don't need to do everything. Some people are going to make music to make us happy, to soothe our souls. Some are going to paint art so we can see beautiful visual art. Some are going to grow our food. Some are going to design our clothes. Some are going to preach a word. Some are going to give inspiration. Some are going to just get a good job so they can help fund the movement. And so I think for me, it's just staying in it and helping myself do my role, but also bringing new people into this movement so we can have more help in this struggle for liberation for our people.
Again, as all, you know, powerful as always. Walter, you about to say something?
No, go ahead.
Oh, so there was there's a lot obviously that does have to happen. What is the best way of being able to merge the grassroots efforts that you do on a daily with the grass tops effort of being able to formulate legislation, whether it's on the federal, state, or local levels, to being able to address the conditions that you are currently working on?
I think that is multi-level, because a lot of times, I think is So when we talk about grassroots, I'm working with a nonprofit that actually has a budget, you know, and it's the Hip Hop Caucus. So we have a pretty nice budget. At one point, I was running around the streets trying to go door to door to organize people around different legislations. But I think people have to find their niche, and then people have to go and sit in these meetings, because to shape policy, to do legislation, it's not an easy process. And like I said, you got to get that education of it. But I think for us, the thing is understanding this. There's a saying Reverend Yearwood always said of the Hip Hop Caucus: demonstration without legislation leads to frustration. So in our demonstration, we got to be
focused. Say it one more time for the people in the back.
Demonstration without legislation leads to frustration. So that means is while you out there demonstrating, yelling and screaming, which is needed, where are you moving the anger and the frustration to? And we have to be smart and wise enough with our leaders and our scholars to not beg the enemy to give a solution and legislation. We need to formulate it, organize it, and actually implement it. And some of the legislation that we're looking for, federal dollars and federal implementation, there are still certain things that we can do in our own community to stop it. And that's why I said we also have to clean up our own community, police our own community, because when we ain't no spook, when there's killing, somebody knows. But if we have a better relationship, we can stop the violence in our community, which allows us to demand the police back up out of community. Why you in here if there's no violence going on? If there's no calls coming, why are you in our community? There's more drug use in a white community, but y'all ain't over there going to get little Tommy. So we have to do our work on the grassroots to make our community a real community, but at the same time, know that when you're organizing the rally, you're organizing the demonstration, that is not a moment, it's a movement, and there's more work. And the reality is that some are cookie cutter activists that are there for the moment just for the yelling and the rallies, but they're not there for the after hours, having those conversations about what that legislation looked like, how do we get it passed, who we need to get it passed from, and all of those nuances that take hours and hours and late nights and time to go through that process. So everybody's not cut out for it, because even with Eric Garner, it took 5 years for them to fire the officer. So when it happened, we was all on social media, but then somebody else got killed and the cameras moved. So that's why I mean, we're nonpartisan, but we're also postpartisan. We're after the cameras leave. We're after the election. We stay on the candidates and we stay in the community even after the cameras have left to make sure that legislation and change actually comes. And that take work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm very proud of what you've done and what you're working towards, what you've accomplished or impacted. But it's no but to that. You know, that's just me, you know, just observing and what you've done and how you addressed us today. So, Ernest, you were going to say something else? Probably pushing up against the clock.
That was the thing. I was recognizing the fact that, you know, we were pushing against the clock. And so, you know, there was, you know, I would love to, you know, before closing, obviously TC, you know, let everybody know like how they can get involved and, you know, in what particular way. But there was one thing that he had touched on. It was earlier. And then also now, two things. One, like there's a level of hypocrisy within our own communities. And I know we talked about hypocrisy of the United States, but there's a level of hypocrisy within our own communities, you know, those who want what it looks like and not necessarily what it feels like to the way TC described, as far as those who will stay for the real work and those who are there for the glitz and the glamour. But just as for the general, for those who are listening, you know, three types of people that, you know, that you'll find. And there are people who are for what you are against. They are not for what you are for, and they are not for you. Okay. Then there are people who are for what you are for. They are not for what you are against, and they are not for you. And then the third person, which is who an activist is and truly embodies, is that they are for you. They are for the people. And those are the type of people that we have to be able to create those strategic partnerships with. Those are the people that we want to be in whatever position and serve in whichever way that they can. But we need to make sure that we're recognizing those three types of people and making sure that we either, one, eliminate those or understand what their role is in this particular moment and movement. But after that, I will digress. TC, I need to be able to connect with you, dog, after this.
All right. Some of my other panelists, some of our other panelists, rather, y'all guys have any closing words?
This is Gene. Just wanted to say thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be on the show, Brother Muhammad. And I want to thank Greg Coleman for having you on the show. There's something different, and I really believe that our listening audience got a lot out of it. And I want to ask you a question directly, TC. As a community leader, community activist, there's no monetary gain for the individual that serves their community, and oftentimes it's a thankless job. What is it about what you do that keeps you engaged and keeps you committed and prevents you from saying, you know what, screw these Negroes, I'm going to take my education, my money, I'm going to go move to the suburbs and make it all about me for the next 30, 40 years that I have left on this earth? Please tell us, brother.
You know, so that's a powerful conversation. So one, this is a lifestyle. So this is not a job for me. This is a lifestyle. Because out of the 30 years, 20 of those years wasn't paid. I'm just now getting in a job where I'm getting paid. I had to work some jobs. But this is a lifestyle. And plus, I love our people. I mean, I genuinely love our people. On the other side of that is that part of my coming up was that, you know, we were the broke revolutionaries. And I say, you ain't got to be broke no more in this revolutionary day. You can be an entrepreneur and make money and still be down for the people. I will also say, be careful who do this for the money, but it's all right to make money and make a living and do this work. Because the work that I've done, I never looked for a check. Money came years after I did the work. And even the job that I have, at one point, I couldn't even pay my phone bill and my boss paid it. And then later I got this job, then I got money. But I'm also trying to use my resources to give resources to others. So the more I get, the more I have to give back. So I just think that it's a love for me. It's in my body. So when they say buy black, I don't have to talk about buying black. That's just what I do ordinarily. I don't have to talk about we need to love. I really love our people. So when you talk about moving to a suburb, it's cool to have a nice space, but I also just love when I go to any city, where are black people? I want to be around us. So I don't have a fear of us. I don't have a dislike of us. I have an innate and in my bones love for us. And I know that it is God's ordained mission for me to do what he has me to do. And I cannot not do what is born in me or what is my purpose in life, and that's to love and help us. And it's not just to help one person, but it's to help all of us get free. So I love to see the gifts and all. So this show is beautiful. So I love to talk about you all and us that are doing something. So this gives me life. This gives me energy. And I remember yelling one time in the office, I went to my elders and I said, y'all the ones caused me to be in this and I can't get out. This is like, y'all, I start working with y'all and I can't get out of it. I probably would have never met y'all. I wouldn't be in this, but I'm in it and I love it.
Beautiful. Great.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. Any further questions for TC before we get ready to prepare to sign off?
No, I just like for TC to just let our audience and listeners know how to get in touch with you, follow you, any organizations and your social media pages.
Yes, Twitter and Instagram is at HipHopTC, HipHopTC, or Terrence Muhammad on Facebook, Terrence Muhammad on Facebook. And you can go to HipHopCaucus.org, HipHopCaucus.org.
Excellent. That'll be in the show notes also, yes. People. Okay.
Yes.
All right. One thing I do want to mention before I turn it over to Michelle is that we do a rebroadcast on Sunday after 3 p.m. All right. So this live show will be rebroadcasted at that time on anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm talking Apple Podcasts. We're talking Google Play. We're talking wherever you get your podcasts, you can find the Walt Weekly Podcast. And so it'll be a replay of this live show released on Sunday after 3 p.m. Okay. And now I'm going to turn it over to Michelle. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining.
Yes. Thank you, Walter. And thank you to our live audience listeners. Thank you for attending our weekly Friday Live. We are here every Friday at 6 p.m. Thank you to our wonderful guest, Mr. Muhammad. We appreciate you, our esteemed panel, Honorable Gene Anthony Edwards, Ernest Johnson, Greg Coleman, and Christopher Sweeney. You can follow us at The Walt Weekly on Instagram, Twitter at Walt Weekly, Facebook, The Walt Weekly Podcast, email thewaltweekly@gmail.com, and www.thewaltweekly.com. You can find us on all streaming platforms, Pandora, iHeartRadio, iTunes, wherever you find your podcasts, we are there. We appreciate everyone for coming out and enjoying this evening with us and this time with us. Terrence, once again, thank you, sir, for being with us again.
Thank you, man.
Yes. Have a great and amazing weekend. Black people, shine all day. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. And have a safe and wonderful weekend. All right. Bye-bye.
Y'all have a great weekend.
Yep, everybody good. CCHU on the IG.